Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is episode 26, where we are going to discuss our fourth Journal of Management Studies classic, this time by Carl Weick, published in 1988 on Enacted Sense-Making in Crisis Situations. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. You may also wish to listen to episode 20, where we discussed a different but related paper by Carl Weick. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Brighton in the United Kingdom.
And this is Joe, coming from Melbourne, Florida.
This is Pedro, coming to you from Brasilia, Brazil's capital.
And this is Thomas, calling from London.
Welcome, everyone, and hi, Thomas. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So Thomas is our special guest for this paper, and we're very happy to have him.
Indeed. So let me just give a brief bio about Thomas for those listeners who don't know him. Thomas is an organizational theorist based at King's College London, and he's also affiliated to other universities like Southside Business School and HSC in Paris. He's mostly interested on negative social evaluations with issues such as stigma and disapproval, and has a broader interest on ethics in the context of professional service firms and cultural industries. Thomas is also the co-editor-in-chief of Management, a journal a bit under the radar, but that he would like to invite you all to send your great work. And most importantly, he's also a fan of the podcast, so we are very pleased to have him here with us.
I love that you inserted into his bio that he's a fan of the podcast.
That is an excellent point. I am a great fan of Talking About Organizations, and I met Pedro at the Academy last year, and I said, you are doing a great job with this podcast, and I'm glad that I'm going to be on it. I mean, I feel a bit like a fanboy that can access the big star I was dreaming to talk with.
I'm blushing now.
That's lovely, yes.
You can tell in the podcast, so we are all fine if I make you blush.
Okay.
lovely. So that was pleasant. I like this. I like this episode already. But let's get to the paper. Does anyone want to give an introduction to what we're discussing today?
Yes, I will. So Weick's 1988 paper examined the Bhopal disaster through the lens of sense-making. He started looking from the perspective of what Union Carbide had actually told its people, including that they would determine the appropriate actions if there was a problem. Weick makes the point that people often don't know what the appropriate action is until they take some action and see what happens. In other words, actions determine the situation. He also notes it's less often true that situations determine appropriate actions than that preconceptions determine the appropriate action. And he finally notes that judgment of appropriateness is likely to be a motivated assessment constructed partially to validate earlier reasoning. So you've cast the future by what you come to the problem with already. He then wraps up in that section, which leads to the assertion that corrections show not so much that Carbide's statement is an error as that Carbide's assessment is incomplete because it misrepresents the contribution of action to human understanding. And that's really a key contribution of sense-making, is how do humans understand? He then discusses the importance of those preconceptions, the process of enactment, and the enacted environment that results over the course of the paper. Interestingly, he discusses the concepts of commitment, especially public commitment, and how it renders people blind to a different perspective, maybe even a more correct one of the situation. Looking towards how do organizations handle crises better, he uses concepts like capacity as a framework for how to respond better to crisis, and then that leads to the consideration of an enactment perspective as a means to improve response to the crises. He wraps up by suggestion that a way to counteract catastrophes, therefore, is to reduce tight coupling and interactive complexity. To do this, it seems important not to blame technology, but rather to look for and exaggerate all possible human contributions to crises in the hope that we can spot some previously unnoticed contributions that where we can exert leverage. Our two other papers I'll touch on briefly, Maitlis and Sonnenschein, introduce Weick's re-examination, which was our third paper. In it, they have an extended examination of sense-making, touch on the difficulty of it in reality, as well as in the reconstruction of crises, and offer how it applies to change management efforts, a field that could be also considered a crisis for some organizations. And they wrap up with suggestions for research, future research, including the politics of sense-making and sense-making as an embodied practice. I found Weick's re-examination of his earlier analysis to be quite interesting, given his benefit of decades of accumulated knowledge. And he uses a term I love called brutal audits. He says, brutal audits, which are the crises, are a harsh reminder that safe functioning is not bankable. My lens of looking at this is my experience as a nuclear operator, where I operated nuclear-powered submarines both on board and in maintenance environments for well over 20 years. And I really loved his words about, in other words, if you watch a compact, specific, short event, then you can grasp most of it with relatively few factors. However, if you have the assumptions that most organizational events are overdetermined and complex, organizational sense-making during crisis is not representative. This issue is important, and investigators need to make their peace with it. This reflects to how when we had problems, and we rarely had what elevated to, in Navy nuclear power, we never had a Bhopal kind of event. But we did have other factors, and how we, when we tried to do the reconstruction, we're not satisfied with just one or two factors, but really, really tried to get as much on the table as we possibly could, looking for, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 or more factors that would play into it rather than being satisfied with the one or two that were easy to come up with.
Actually, reading this, I was struck by how much our previous discussions of Weick and specifically high reliability organizing have internalized for me, because studying Weick and Weick's work within organization theory and organization studies context, it was one thing, but now that we had the benefit of talking to Ralph and Joe and Tom Mercer and other high reliability people, now coming back to Weick, it's like, oh, this is different. So that's an interesting act of introspective sense making there.
What I find quite interesting as well, I mean, connected to what you are saying, Dimitris, is the fact that if you read this this paper about Bhopal from 1988, you see that it connects with like so many different areas and fields. Like it connects with institutions, it connects with organizational learning. He cites preference analysis, so resource dependence, social information processing. It's one of those papers that kind of provide some overarching framework in organization theory, and that anybody coming from any field can find something in this white piece. So I think it's really something that we should all read and read again. And if you look at the summary that Joe made was excellent. The one thing that we didn't touch upon, and that I thought was quite interesting in the paper by Maitlis and Sonnenschein, and it's quite a hot topic, it's the role of emotions. So if you look at any sort of theory nowadays, sense-making or institutions or institutional theory, the role of emotion is quite crucial. And when Joe talked about his experience in the nuclear submarine, I was thinking about this. Like, I mean, like, what is the influence of emotions? I mean, are there things that we didn't think about with the original sense-making theory, the enactment theory, things that we didn't think about and that you faced in your experience as a submarine operator?
I love that you went straight there, because I was I was saving emotions and physicality for later. But
sorry, I'm spoiling the rest of I'm already spoiling the rest of the podcast.
That's okay.
No way. I always believe that we should eat dessert first, so there you go.
should maybe, before we get to dessert, maybe let's say a few words about the process of enactment so that it makes a bit more sense for those who haven't read the paper. And then I'm super happy to go into emotions and other things, because that's really what I wanted to talk with you guys about. Because this enactment, and that alludes to what both Joe and Thomas just said, that it's a it's not one thing, and it's certainly not a colloquial term. That Wyke defines it as this compound process of four different things, which are the self-fulfilling prophecies, the retrospective sense-making, the commitment, interestingly, as Joe pointed out, and then the social information processing. And I mean, this whole idea of enactment being a process and a product of itself, I think that's one of the kind of key paradigm shifting aspects of Wyke's work altogether. Doesn't seem that unusual now, or maybe because of the work in process and practice that kind of me and Pedro are doing, but it's, you know, thinking back that this was in 88, it's really great, this idea that the experience both constructs and is constructed through the environment. That actually echoes what we did in the previous episode with Sarah Kaplan, with the paper by Porak around the same time. So we can really see, observing these two and other works around kind of late 80s, that something's happening, that something's big is changing in the field, from this more functionalist economics approach to organizations to one where individuals and their internal environments are becoming more important and central.
I see that actually it's more about carving out a space, because we still have, I would say, a dominant idea about cognition. It's actually getting a bit worse if you think about the whole ideas about neurobiology and neurosciences that are used in management nowadays. But this idea that cognition is not something that just happens inside the brains, but it's social, it's intertwined with meaning, and most importantly, has a grasp on the way that we go about our lives. It depends on how we understand the situation. That is, the situation is not completely direct out there for us, but depends on how we understand that. And that's a social meaning process.
Well, it's a bit different here, though. It's not quite like that, because at least if I understood what you're saying, and if I understood what they were saying, is the cognition is retired to the backseat. And they actually say on page 307 that cognition lies in the path of action. So action precedes cognition.
Yes, yes. That's what I was trying to say. How can I put this? I agree that action comes first, but the idea is that this is a meaning-making process all the time, in a way. So the action feeds itself in meaning, then that feeds more action, so on and so forth. But it's much more intertwined than a loop cycle.
Yes, I mean, the originality of the Wyke paper was to actually say that action precedes cognition, that you act and then you can take stock of your environment and assess the situation. And so he kind of like took a completely different approach to crisis management by saying, well, people react first and that helps them make sense of the crisis situation. And in most cases, they are very likely that by their action, they will make the situation even worse. And that's why human intervention is sometimes triggering a crisis or accentuating crisis.
And it really puts a dent into this whole idea of a manager being a rational man, doesn't it? That the rationality is no longer the primary culprit in any of this activity. And it's actually the action that, as you said, sort of shapes everything, which is the really interesting idea that we do things first and then make sense of them rather than the other way around.
So when I did operate nuclear power plants, one of the things that I noticed is we have in our manuals what are called infrequent and backup operations. And so because I implicitly understood this concept, I didn't have the academic paper, but because I implicitly understood this concept, I actually had a schedule that had my operators perform every single one of them, those procedures, in a non-threatening environment. And some of them required my presence. Some of them required one of my next level down managers to be present for. But what I wanted to do was have them actually perform that action in a non-threatening environment so that when it came time to do it in a crisis, they knew how to do it and had already been through this loop once.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, when you think about the 2010 paper about applying this to change management, I find that interesting because I now, as a consultant, try to encourage the organizations to actually do something, go through the loop, and then decide, did it work or not? Did they like it? Did they have to change it? Rather than just talking about it, but to actually take action. So my practice now is informed because I'm familiar with the literature. I find it interesting that you can tumble to it, and it's so broadly tumbled to how you go do that correctly and how you do it in a beneficial way for organizations.
I mean, the idea of action also connects very well with the whole literature on learning from failure. So mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. usually better to have failure to learn. So, I mean, if there are only successes, it's really hard to improve. While if you actually do something and then you fail, then you can improve your operations. And so that's, I think, another key element that has informed or fed the literature on organizational learning.
There's so much in there that even speaking of cognition, the whole idea of failure's significance to learning. I remember I was doing a work research on this management consultancy that specialized in using the stratified systems theory by Elliot Jacks, which is kind of this mm-hmm. semi-cognition focused way of analyzing organizations. And their approach to enhancing the health and safety for their clients was by making them fail as soon as possible, because that triggered a cognitive process of sort of reprogramming the way that the brain kind of computes the sense-making activity, which is super interesting.
I think there is also something else on the Vike insight, because I think this idea of running through the scenario before it happens, you know, other people that has studied surprises show that as well, that, you know, once you are aware of kind of, you know, similar situations, you can better handle that. But there's another thing that I think Vike adds, that is not only the experience that you had before that helps, so the lessons that you learned, or just the experience of, you know, having done that in a less threatening environment, but also the general, I would say, feeling of this more proactivity, this idea that as humans we can somehow, if actions matter so much, we can actually handle crises in a way that we are going to tame them down by the series of actions that we might take, which in a way creates like what I, reading between the lines, see as a more, I would say, positive cycle. You know, this idea that you can do something and you do the action, and that kind of, you know, leads to a possible resolution. I don't know if I'm the only one to see that, or is
no. But if you read the Maitlis and Sonnenschein summary, they say the perspective of Vike on crisis is very optimistic. I mean, he thinks that through this process of action that precedes cognition, the enactment, actually, this is a positive thing to understand how to learn from crisis and to ensure that crises are not reproduced.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in their review paper, they highlight that actually the sense-making activity prolonged the crisis.
No, I mean, I think they are critical on this point by Vike by saying that it's not only about doing actions and learning from your actions and then like basically making sense of the situation after actions have been taken. It's that potentially it can go two ways. It can go in a way that it's like the crisis lasts longer because people struggle to make sense. They aggravate the crisis. They aggravate the crisis through more actions that are more mistakes or more errors. But also, what Vike is saying is that potentially through this process of sense-making, people can also come to realize where the crisis comes from, like in a shorter time period. They might need less time to realize what needs to be fixed for crisis not to be reproduced. At least that's my understanding, is that basically Sally Maitlis and Scott Sonnenschein, they say it can go two ways.
So I think that was Wyke who actually said that in his abstract as well as in the body about the prolonged. And I think it was because they captured on the wrong, their sense-making was flawed, the amount that did, and that reinforced their misperceptions about what was happening, and that's what prolonged it, rather than it being a general fact that sense-making will prolong an event.
Well, hang on. Does it make much sense talking about things like correct or incorrect sense-making? That, you know, if their theory seems to be well-disposed to just construction of reality as such, that sense-making is a making of, you know, some kind of a sense. So there is no, I mean, the relation of right to wrong or...
Let's not use the right to wrong, but perhaps the correlation to what actually is as opposed to what they think it is.
Yeah, but what they think it is.
I agree. So you have this problem, right? Where if what they think it is, and then that drives their actions, but that doesn't match the facts on, you know, the actual physical reality, then it gets worse, not better.
Well, insofar as Wyke seems to be concerned, the physical reality is restricted to just that, objects that are like these props in the world. He says that the existence of objects is not questioned, but their significance, meaning, and content is, which means that any kind of social consequence of objects is determined by the people who use them. I think maybe the better kind of focal point with this whole sense-making business is the discrepancy between what's happening and what they expect to happen. So it kind of adds this another layer to the sense-making process, the one where they sort of reflect on what is going on. So the making of a sense at the same time as comparing that to some kind of expected or desired outcomes that they would like to experience.
Yes, like expectation is one of the pillar of the theory. I think I see what you guys are saying, basically, because enactment, this is the idea that phenomena are created by just the fact of being talked about, being thought about, and having been at the origin of a decision process. So talking about right or wrong sense making, it could come to what is the correlation between the phenomena as it is talked about and the actual facts. So in the case of a crisis, in the case of the Bhopal crisis, is there a divergence between what people thought was happening and what was actually happening? And at a posteriori, after events, after crisis, you can have some ideas of what people perceived was going wrong, what's according to people, what were the things that were going wrong that needed to be fixed, and what was actually wrong. So I think that might be one idea to think about what is right and what is wrong forms of sense making.
I also think that, I always end up playing the devil's advocate, but I feel that we have been praising Wyke so much, so I have to, I would say, put a spin on it and maybe start talking about some of its weakness. And I think that this point illustrates exactly that. Because although I understand that in his conception, sense-making is a more social process and is much more than what is in the head of the people, but I think that the apparatus that he gives to analyze these circumstances end up being one in which it's too much what is being talked about, but it's less on what is really happening, you know. And I miss a bit that of the organization out there, you know. So I compare him to someone like Diane Vogan, who has studied the Challenger explosion in NASA and has produced a wonderful research and book about that and showing how the culture of NASA and a series of concrete practices and routines that the organization had end up making the people that work there kind of, you know, unaware of certain risks or... And there you can see the organization in action, and you can see not only what the people are talking about and how meaning is being constructed, but actually what are the real practices out there, you know. And I think that the Wyke perspective doesn't give us this ability to capture that as much. So that's why I see Dimitris is saying this idea that, you know, what is being talked is, because we don't really see what is outside, because that it wouldn't be in the Vike framework, something like that.
Well, it's a bit tricky, because you're right, definitely, especially with regards to him placing so much emphasis on action. There is not really much evidence of that in these research outputs.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a sense, for me, and this is partially informed by kind of what little I know of evolutionary biology, that the process of making sense is only cognitive, but what feeds that, the activity, that is not really analyzable in a socially meaningful way, because that is not made sense of. So it's not a conscious thing. So he's focusing on the things that make that are relatable to a group of people, whereas activity, I think, in this framework is not seen as qualifying for that. Do you see what I'm saying?
I'm a bit lost, to be honest.
Well, let me draw an analogy to kind of the human brain. I think that might help. So traditionally thought, the brain has three parts: the reptilian brain, which is the most basic one, the emotional brain, which evolved later and kind of deals with emotional responses and feeds memory, and that this, I think, is kind of what these first two stages are, what Wyke clusters under action. And then we have the neocortex, the rational brain, that is producing rationalizations and these cognitive constructs and all the thing that we're doing right now, actually. So in a crisis situation, the thesis is that people tend to freak out, and once that happens, the neocortex retreats, giving way to these more instinctual, learned, and embodied responses to the situation. Kind of when Joe was talking about that he is having his clients kind of do something once or twice, it almost becomes embodied as a way of responding. But because the activity, this responsive kind of a reflex to the environment, is not cognitive, I think maybe, and I may be way off with this, maybe in Wyke's framework, at least as outlined in these papers that we're reading, there is no space for activity that is not cognizable.
I didn't expect you to go all the way in neurobiology. I don't think we can be friends anymore.
Yes, I think we have a paper there, like a neuroscientific perspective on sense making. You can do IRM and brain scanning, and that would, I think, do give a good contribution to the sense making literature.
But that's my problem. I don't want to be the party booster, but exactly, I read sense-making exactly as a response to this kind of very reductive ideas of cognition that is actually based on, boiling it down to processes in the brain. I think there is an emergent property in social aspects. And I think that Vike would be someone that would subscribe to this more emergent perspective. But I'm not an expert on his work, so I don't know which way it goes, cognition for him.
Well, no, I agree with you. I think I probably went a bit too minute with this, but certainly action and other human attributes such as emotions, like what Thomas mentioned at the very beginning, but then also more social things like politics, as mentioned by Maitlis and Sonnenschein, those are clearly absent in this work, and that might be just a function of when it was published, but it's certainly something that we'd be interested in today, and I'm very interested in the emotional aspect of this.
Yes, and it's quite interesting because Maitlis and Sonnenschein, they present emotions under the umbrella of shared meanings. So what are the shared elements that will produce or trigger forms of sense-making at the individual, at the collective level? But this phenomenon that they want to look at of emotions, it's under the umbrella of what generates shared meaning. And I thought it was quite interesting because emotions, this could be something that is very differentiated at the individual level. So is it only a trigger of shared meaning, or does it trigger individual forms of sense-making and variance within a crowd of individuals facing a crisis? Do they actually differ in their process of sense-making because they have different emotion? One person is angry about the situation, one person is scared or panicked. So, the question is, like, emotion, is it about the collective meanings and the collective process of sense-making or the individual process of sense-making. And I think there is a need for clarity around those questions, but not only for sense-making, for emotions in other literatures.
By emotions, they, I think, have two separate things there. One is emotions as we, I think, understand, but also the one that precedes that, arousal. So they mentioned that arousal stimulates sense making, so it's kind of a spark for the whole process.
Yeah, arousal. I was like wondering exactly what they were thinking about, to be honest.
Well, when I read this, I had an image of my dog when he's doing his thing, and then or he notices that I have a treat in my hand for him or something like that, and then he stops, focuses on me, and then his ears kind of go a bit forward. So that for me is an image of arousal. It's this stimulus that kind of mobilizes the individual into this position of being ready to react to the environment or something like that. It's almost like an animating quality.
No, I agree. I think that's the way, the generic way to see it. Yeah, it's like action reaction and like what creates alertness. They mentioned that as well, but I mean, that's how I understood the concept.
I think alertness is a good term for this.
So it's interesting, the whole concept of emotion. For at least the first part of my career, was largely sought to remove emotion from the situation. Let's call it that. It's only later that you come to realize how important emotion is and how it can be a leading indicator of someone who senses something is wrong. I would say it's far more incorporated these days, so that it's not sought to generally, I'll put it this, generally not sought to be submerged or put away, but to be recognized as an important element. You know, if we go back to some of the situations, though, I could see how we structured it to try to remove emotion, but allowed it to be present and use it. So I can't use that story. So it's
well, now we're curious.
Yeah, it's one of those. Yeah, now you're curious. Yeah,
there's another one.
Yeah, so so I'm just thinking about how to phrase this. The most successful organizations that I have been part of, I'll put it this way, in these situations, have recognized the value of allowing emotion within limits.
Okay.
And it gets to be part of the equation for the decision making, but then once the decision is made, the emotion gets subtracted out, if you will, and we try to keep it as, you know, professional as possible. So in one particular case, so I was investigating officer for a submarine that had a problem. The crew actually evacuated the submarine. We rescued all 43 crew members. No one was killed, which is absolutely amazing. And when you looked at it, they had no less than 7 opportunities to either sink themselves or otherwise, have a mass casualty situation. And when we talked to the crew afterwards, it was obvious that there were some crew members who had largely been ineffective, but they had been carefully placed aside, if you will, and the crew that remained running the casualty were able to make an astounding set of decisions when you look back, such that there was no loss of life and we didn't lose the submarine. And in that case, the primary emotion that came was fear, but it was used to their advantage. And they recognized it. The commanding officer, saw it, handled it, and they got through it. You know, so there There is no case study.
Well, there is a good case study, actually.
Well, it is, but the Navy is unlikely to release it. So I would offer that you know, having been in and run high reliability organizations, the recognition of emotion is important. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of how do you use it to your advantage rather than being lost.
But the only thing that it was not very clear to me is that, you know, when you're talking about emotions, to go back again to what, sorry, Thomas, I'm stealing all your ideas, but whether we are talking about individual emotions or the group emotions, because you can, you know, when you talk about fear, was something that was felt by specific individuals that were able to canalize that, it was something that was shared, or similarly, when we say that organizations traditionally try to factor out emotions, I imagine that they try to factor out individual emotions, that, you know, this idea that, you know, individuals should be as rational as possible, not be biased by this thing called emotions, but it creates a specific emotional state as a whole in a group, which is this kind of more, I would say, alert or, I would say, neutral tone. I don't know how to express that, but you see, it creates a group level kind of state at the same time.
There's two parts to this, basically, the individual and the collective. And shall we discuss the individual now and then leave the collective for part two? Because I think there's a few things here.
Okay.
So yeah, what Pedro said, but I'm also curious with regards to the situation that you described, Joe, the emotion that sort of helped these people make the decisions that saved them and their equipment. You said it was fear, but was it that fear helped them make sense of the situation in the way that, as we discussed previously, is like correct, quote unquote?
So what I believe is looking at it from the lens of they had various fears that then got discussed and translated into action. So one of their fears was that they could sink. Mm-hmm. They had an option to drop a large amount of lead ballast that would have seemingly improved their situation, but in fact would have actually made their situation worse. Because if they dropped the lead, it would have imbalanced the submarine, and they would have lost another surfacing force of their attachment to the surface of the ocean. And they actually went through that, had the discussion in a small group, and then decided not to drop the lead. Turns out, looking retrospectively, that was the correct decision, both from the obvious fact that they made it back, but also from the analysis that was done later that confirmed the reality. So it was the various concerns that they surfaced, discussed, determined a path forward on. Is I think where they had the emotions come into play.
That's very interesting, because in their paper Mateless and Sonnenschein, they say explicitly that emotion, and specifically felt emotion, has traditionally been seen as an impediment to cognitive processing in general and to sense making in particular, citing one of Wyke's work as well.
And Wyke discusses that in his second paper in depth, talking about how the morale at the plant led the decision-making down a poor path. In this case, because I think the morale and the leaders who were there recognized that the problems had to be surfaced, but they needed to be rapidly disposed and an action taken, or at least in the lead ballast case, an action not taken, which is in itself an action, that enabled the clarity to remain rather than being paralyzed by the emotion.
I think one of the interesting things that this touches upon is whether organization or whether they can actually suppress emotions to improve the sense-making process. I mean, are there organizations that repress emotions? And what is the role of organizations in channeling emotions? I mean, you mentioned fear. I mean, are organizations taking advantage of that? Can they actually take advantage of that? What is the part of agency in the role of organizations in triggering emotions to generate positive forms of sense making.
I think it's important that to distinguish that emotions that are usually tried to be eliminated by organizations are a very specific set of emotions. So it's either to do with the negative emotions like fear or uncertainty and things like that, but it almost never has to do with positive emotions like passion, you know, for work or engagement and things like that. So I think we should be a bit specific with regards to which emotions we mean, because there's this inherent managerial hypocrisy within this concept as well.
Mm-hmm.
That it's accepted as long as it's beneficial to organizational outcomes.
Yeah, true.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, we need not to forget about all the positive emotions that organizations can trigger. So like passion, as you said, I mean, what is the role of passion in sense making? The issue there is, are positive emotions all positive for sense making? If you are a passionate worker, can you actually take the best decisions? Can you actually make sense of the situations in the most accurate way? This is not clear either. So positive or negative emotions, we can distinguish them, but it's actually quite hard to say positive emotions have a positive impact on sense making, negative emotions have a negative impact on sense making.
Well, no, in Joe's case, it was clearly that the negative emotion had a positive impact.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's all for part one of episode 26. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you're enjoying our discussion. And if so, please let us know. Get in touch with us on social media or leave a review on iTunes. That always helps new people find the podcast. Remember that we now have a newsletter that comes out every Wednesday and to which you can subscribe by going to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com and just scrolling a bit down. Please come back next week as we finalize our discussion with Thomas about enacted sense making in crisis situations here on Talking About Organizations.